When I came in this morning, somebody said, you brought your whole library. In 20 minutes, we're going to do all of that. So what I did with the Schweitzer piece, where he says, at times our own light goes out and is rekindled by the spark from another. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have rekindled the flame within us. So what I did was I thought, well, what are the sparks that have lit the flame within me on this religious journey of mine? And so I just sat with that and went with the names and the things that came to mind. Can you see over there if I sit on the stool? There you go. All right. And I thought about where to start. And so I was thinking about Nelson Mandela, obviously. And if you got your New Yorker magazine, those of you who get that magazine, he's on the front. It's a younger Mandela. But it actually took me back to the first sermon that I ever wrote at Divinity School. And it took me back to that time. It was written around Easter in 1989. And we'll get back to 1989. And if you know anything about first sermons, they include everything that you'll ever say ever again. And also it included, Judy said, and the kitchen sink. It did include the death of my dog, so, you know. And also South Africa. So that's how I get around to this. And apartheid. And it's all connected. That's the wonder of it all. Because I went back and read it. And at some point, I should read it here. But the thing is, it was at my field ed site, which was the first parish in Lincoln, Massachusetts. And they have a tradition, or they did then, of half an hour sermons. But I went back and read the sermon. And what had happened was that that winter, so it's 1989, and if you remember, de Klerk began the apartheid changes, the getting rid of apartheid in 1990, and it wasn't until 93, it was a period of 3 years. So the Reverend Theo Kotze and his wife Helen came to speak at First Parish in Lincoln, and they were in exile at that time. They weren't just on vacation in the United States. They were in exile from South Africa. And they shared their experience. And they made apartheid real to me. And what I brought was that sermon. And 1989, it's typed. It actually was printed off the computer. But it's a very real document. So first I have to go through all the other things and the, you know, dog dying. But last month, the Reverend Theo Kotze, in exile from South Africa, preached on this very questioning. The title of the sermon, by the way, is Struggling to Live Well. I haven't answered that or solve that puzzle the whole time, but I realize all the pieces of that struggle and how I frame it are in here, and the challenges. He preached on the title, What on Earth Are We Here For? That was the title. And in his answer, he brought home to me the evils of apartheid, the evils of a system of separateness and the exploitation such thinking supports. South Africa moved into my circle of compassion in a new way. The name, South Africa, became faces for me and is now hurting used people. Apartheid, he said, destroys not only those who are oppressed, but it destroys the nature of every human being who is involved. Quote, you cannot diminish another without diminishing yourself. That stuck with me as if it was scripture, but it's something Theo Kotze said. You cannot diminish another without diminishing yourself. We are not called to seek first wealth and position for ourselves, our own family, or our own group, he said, but we are called to seek to ensure that the rights of others are fulfilled. The right, the opportunity for all to live life to the full before God. What I would like to share is that, and I'll share a little more about it, but my background was, or is, in ecology, evolutionary biology, conservation biology. So in this sermon that included everything, I tied that sense of apartheid to the natural world, others who do not have the right to live fully before God. And I said that I have to look at the apartheids that I'm living with my own life. And so that's been a challenge for me ever since. In other words, who are the beings, who are the other people, the beings that I live literally on the back of, so that I can live the style of life I want to live? And that's been a challenge that's come forward with me from that time, is the notion of apartheid. And then Nelson Mandela became the face of that sense of trying to free ourselves, trying to answer the question, what are we on earth for? And answer the question of what it means to live well. So that's just a piece of going back to Lincoln, Massachusetts. But a little about Lincoln, Massachusetts. It's this time of year where that is your postcard town of what you see. Well, it would be even more so if the leaves were changing, but it's now there. And the church that we met in was the first parish in Lincoln meeting house. It's this white wooden building with big windows all along the side, a big steeple standing there, not on the green because the road passes it by in a certain way, but there it is. And I present it to you as a way to make tradition and history real as we move forward, because it is a Unitarian Universalist Association and the United Church of Christ, Federated Church. They're in agreement. The minister now is Unitarian Universalist trained, but the one, Nancy Rockwell, when I was there, she was a United Church of Christ minister. And you sort of go, how does that happen? But we'll get to that. A member of the congregation at the time was a great, great something. I don't know how many great grandsons of John Adams, one of the founders of the time that I was there. One of the big people was Martha de Normandy, and the de Normandies got their land as a grant from the king. And Lincoln is connected to Concord. It's also connected to Walden Pond, for those of you who know Thoreau and Walden, by footpaths, bike paths, conservation easements on the estate. It was founded in 1747. So when was the American Revolution? 1776. So it was founded in 1747. And here's the historical biographical notes, and it's a way to grasp the story of early Unitarianism in America. So when you think that the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Hendersonville just appeared here, think again. And when somebody says it's just this sect that occurred here, think again. But here's the biographical notes from their papers in the library. The first parish in Lincoln, so this is where I'm going, I'm actually working The first parish in Lincoln was established 1747 in the second precinct of Concord, Lexington, and Weston. And those are the towns you read about in the American Revolution. Some 7 years prior to Lincoln's incorporation as a town, the church followed the Orthodox traditions established by Massachusetts law. So that's why it's called a parish. It was actually a taxing unit, and that was the state religion, and you were taxed to support the congregation. I kind of like that, but it didn't last very long. And it said, during the tumultuous times in Massachusetts church history during the late 18th, early 19th century, the first parish split into two factions, those favoring the traditional Orthodox interpretation, later Congregationalists, and those favoring a more liberal aspect of theology, later Unitarians. The Unitarian Party separated from First Parish in 1841, some 11 years after disestablishment of the Orthodox Church. Discussions to consider the merger of the two Lincoln churches began in the 1920s after the century-old theological differences had become blurred. And so, anyway, in 1942, the two churches merged and were formally federated as the First Parish in Lincoln. And there is a stone church just less than a block down the road, which is now the church offices and where the religious education. It's a lot like what we have here, only they weren't churches. So there you have it. You have the Congregationalists and the Unitarians, but they were all one group. And within that group, here I come and who I am. I am a conservation biologist. That's what I'd done for a living. Had been open to a sense of something more. I've decided to go to divinity school to explore that sense and put words to it. It's not to become religious the way you understand religion. It's to understand how this all fits in the big picture. And that's something that's very hard to share and get across, because everybody wants to know, what do you believe and why are you saying that and why are you not saying this? But it's the sense of how do we orient in this big picture. So here I am. I've come to Unitarian Universalism because it's the only organized, and some would say more or less organized, it's the only organized institution in America which deals with these questions in a way that I felt was open enough for me to do that exploration, to find that orientation, to work within that bigger picture. And so I had decided to go to divinity school and yada, yada, and ended up in Massachusetts and then at Lincoln. So history, those sparks to think back on and have moments. I appreciate you allowing me to go back there to think with deep gratitude of those sparks that have started me on the religious journey. Our reading this morning, responsive reading, The Great End in Religious Instruction, William Ellery Channing, Boston. I lived in Boston. I traveled to Lincoln. He lived in Boston right at this same time. And he's the person who wrote the sort of the sermon that defined Unitarian Christianity, okay? Selected writings. I'm not going to go there. But what he did in that sermon, 1819, so that's just in a lifetime after the founding of First Parish in Lincoln, one of the things he said was in that sermon, please note, this is the Bible, just to show you this book. Our leading principle in interpreting Scripture is this, that the Bible is a book written for men in the language of men, and that its meaning is to be sought in the same manner as that of other books. 1819. Now, all books and all conversation require in the reader or hearer the constant exercise of reason, or their true import is only to be obtained by continual comparison and inference. We profess not to know a book which demands a more frequent exercise of reason than the Bible. And it goes on and to say that with these views of the Bible, we feel it is our bounden duty to exercise our reason upon it perpetually, to compare, to infer, to look beyond the letter to the spirit, to seek in the nature of the subject and the aim of the writer his true meaning, and in general, to make use of what is known for explaining what is difficult and for discovering new truths. Deny us this latitude, and we must abandon this book to its enemies. And what happened in that sermon, and where he continued with that, was from doing that work with the Bible, the Unitarians, those ministers really, concluded that Jesus was not God, that there could only be one God. So, hence the name Unitarian, as opposed to Trinitarian. And the reason I'm saying it like that is it had a profound consequence. It meant that we could be like Jesus. It wasn't about just the theology or the sense of Jesus as somebody extra special. He was an exemplar, a teacher, and we could be like him. And what's happened as we've gone through the years since then, not that very long, we've discovered other exemplars, other people who know what it means to live well in relation to God, as it were, or to the sense of the universe. And we'll speak about that a little bit. But that's the key piece in there. And to remember that it's biblically based. That was their scholarship. That's what they were arguing for. It didn't stay there that long. Ralph Waldo Emerson, I won't read from him either, but he lived in Concord, so just down the road from Lincoln. And you can go by his house, and his was the house where Thoreau took his laundry to get it done from Walden, and also went to have meals there. But he wrote the Divinity School address, which was delivered at Harvard Divinity School, and I've told you I painted those rooms as part of my work study where he delivered the address. But what he says in there is pretty much that revelation is unsealed. It's not just in the Bible, it's in our personal experience. We're having it all the time. And some of his language is, the intuition of the moral sentiment is an insight of the perfection of the laws of the soul. He talks about the eternal revelation in the heart. And then in the Divinity School address, he challenged all the graduate students to cast behind you all conformity and acquaint men at first hand with deity on a weekly basis. Revelation is ongoing. But that's what he was saying. So if you now take that, so now he's moved it outside the Bible. Okay, he's moved it, this notion of what it means to live well outside the Bible. I'm going to bring it forward 70 years, skipping a lot in the interest of time. And particular sparks were one, Henry Nelson Wyman in the 1920s, he described God not as a being, but as a creative something in our experience. He talked about creative interchange, and that's the notion I put forward for you today. It's the idea of having a conversation not for winning, not for fighting, but for discovering, creating something new, new insight. He thought of it really as participation in creation, participation in that creative force. And then I've talked about James Luther Adams, and I had tea at his house when I was at Divinity School. And he talked about this congregation as a voluntary association. It's our choice to create, maintain, and carry forward. There's something important about what we are doing this morning, more important than our individual time. By being here, he said, we are participating and contributing our part to the very fabric of the American experiment. So if you fast forward, and I've skipped over all these people, the Unitarians and the Universalists in this book, and then all their writings, which is a huge amount of stuff. The two professors that gave me the sparks I've talked about recently, There's a shift here. Notice, they're both women. Whereas before, all the language was about men. Now these professors are women. And over half of the Unitarian Universalist ministers now are women. So there is that change, and there's that change in the time I've been a minister. The first one is Sharon Parks. And she's the one who gave me the notion of faith as meaning-making, not something that only religious people have, but something that all humans do. It's how do you work with that question, what are we here for? What does it mean to live well? That's the faith work as I see it. Faith not as an assent to proposition, but as ongoing activity of deep meaning-making. Seeking to be at home and feel that belonging in the universe, how do you participate in a trustworthy way, in a meaningful life? I think we're all creating and living faith-filled lives, but we want to be supported and helped in that work in community. Another spark she gave me was how the imagination works, not as a creation of fantasy, but as a participant in new insight. When things begin to break down and we're troubled, Pema Chodron has that book, When Things Fall Apart, okay? How does the new insight, where does the new organizing understanding come from? But imagination is that working, always going on. But what she said, and again, it goes back to the body knows, is that you have to pause at some point. And in our world, the notion of pause is almost impossible. You have to pause at some point. Let the body do its work. Let the imagination do its work for the new insight to come, the new aha that lets you go forward in life. Think about how that goes back to what Emerson said. Revelation is ongoing, but it's also take care of it. Sharon Welch, feminist ethic of risk. She's a Unitarian Universalist, now a professor at Meadville Lombard. She gave me this rich language of understanding that spoke to my experience and helped me know where I stood. She gave me the language and sense of commitment and possibility that inspire confidence to go forward. Emily Towns writes, Welch's goal, an admirable, ultimately practical one, is to craft an ethic that helps us learn on a daily basis how to live creatively, responsively, and compassionately in the present. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I like it. Two sparks. She held up the notion of middle class or cultured despair. And that stuck with me. I am comfortable enough that I can talk about what needs to be fixed, and I can always go home into my comfort and then forget about whatever needs to be done. End of story. That's it. That challenge goes with me all the time. Middle class or cultured despair. That's when we get fired up about what needs to be done. And then we go home to where things are good. The other thing she talked about is the notion of grace. I'd love to leave you with that, and I'll end that. It's not the opposite of works. It is the gift of being loved and loving that enables work for justice. The connotations of grace are many, and there are many that I want to affirm. It's a power or an intensity of relationship that is more than we can predict or produce solely by our own volition. This surplus connoted by grace, the deep joy of loving and being loved, the amazing changes possible in people's lives is sometimes interpreted as a gift from outside. Grace being the gift of a force, a person, grace is the gift of God or the goddess. I would argue that grace is not the manifestation of the divine in our lives, the gift of a separate or foundational being, but that grace is all there is or need be of the divine. That sense of something more, however you want to call it. I'll skip over this, but you'll see there's a theme or a thread that's moving through this. And I will hold up the words of Gordon McKeeman, a lifelong Universalist minister and past president of Star King School for the Ministry, where he holds up the tradition. His words came to me in a pause. I was sitting on the couch with the UU World magazine, And I opened it, and he had a little letter to the editor. And the words came in the answer for the three big theological questions I had posed. And they've become the words of for the orientation of these faith traditions that say, yes, life is like that, like this. He said, our universalist tradition says one human family, one origin, one nature, one destiny. Inclusive. Take that back to where we started with apartheid. There are no apartheids created by God. One human family. So, and it's our job to end those apartheids. Unitarian tradition, he said, an exalted view of human possibility with Jesus as an exemplar. So we expand that to say there are many exemplars, and we can be like them. So if you ask the question, what does it mean to live well? Look to the exemplars and try to be like them. Try to make the inclusive nature of the universe real in the world. Yes, life is like this. Another moment, I saw those words in the chalice. I saw those traditions in the chalice. And I've begun to use it as orientation and compass. So the rings become the traditions, the perspective on the world, an inclusive universe, universalism, an inclusive universe, a loving God, frame it as no apartheids. That would be very simple and action-oriented. The Unitarian tradition, an exalted view of who we can be in the world. And when you ask the question, what does it mean to live well, you can begin to look to religious exemplars for those answers. And then there is the chalice. What are we to do with our lives? What is it that we're supposed to be? I have the notes here. Our lives, our actions, each worship, we light the spark, the flame, what? The flame within us from the sparks again. That's what it becomes. But the other thing is the space out of which this emerges. The space of this voluntary association, the space of beloved community, the space of committing to making a place where we can have and be that creative interchange, where we can have those new insights, when we can discover and support ourselves in living faith-filled lives. At times, our light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another. Each of us has cause, I would say, to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us.